from 89.3 KPCC. This is Take Two. Me, Martinez. Thanks for choosing us this Friday. All right, let's kick off this $5 Friday with some state of affairs. It's our weekly peek at politics in the Golden State. And this week, Governor Newsom's bill signing earns him some cheers and jeers from liberal allies. We're going to get into that. Meanwhile, presidential hopeful Kamala Harris takes a bit of a dive in the polls. We'll look at her narrow path to a comeback. Let's get into those stories and more with Jack Pitney. He's the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Hello, Jack.
Good afternoon.
Also with us, Carla Marinucci, senior editor for Politico's California Playbook. Hello, Carla.
Hey, good to be with you.
All right, let's start with lawmakers who sent 1,042 bills to Governor Newsom's desk. He vetoed over 100 of those last week, and those vetoes have earned him criticism from his allies. Carla, who did he disappoint at the end of this season?
Well, you know, there were a couple of powerhouse labor and progressive groups, for starters, that came away unhappy with Gavin's veto pen. He kind of channeled Jerry Brown in there. And you had the California Nurses Association, for example, crying foul. That's when Gavin Newsom vetoed a bill regulating hospital closures. It basically required a 90 days notice, essentially, for a closure. And they basically accused the governor of craven submission to hospital interests in Wall Street. So, you know, he said he was sympathetic to that argument, but he couldn't force financially strapped hospitals to stay open when the writing was on the wall. You know, there was a CTAA. They got angered when Newsom vetoed a bill that would have required schools to offer at least one full-day kindergarten program in the 22-23 school year. Newsom cited the budget again on that. And, you know, progressives were miffed when he vetoed a bill aimed at improving voter turnout. That was a Lorena Gonzalez bill that would have required county elections officials to send out notices ahead of elections, basically informing voters of their political party preference so they could switch, etc. He said that would have an impact on the budget. So there it went. Jerry Brown, channeled by Gavin Newsom, and basically getting the same reaction from some of the labor and progressive groups out there.
All right. So we got the CTA, the California Teachers Association, the California Nurses Association, Jack, at the root, really two very powerful groups. Actually, the California Nurses Association endorsed Governor Newsom when he ran. Is he taking a bit of a political risk by disappointing these two very powerful allies?
Potentially. You don't want to anger nurses. You know, trust me on that. My sister's a nurse. but seriously, the nurses have campaign money. They have people power. They walk the precincts. And they have public support for 17 years in a row. Gallup has found that the most trusted profession in America is nursing.
Well, they care for us in our weakest moments, right? I mean, yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so they have automatically in any conflict, they start off with public sympathy and public support. All that said, this is potentially a problem for him, but he has a lot of time, a lot of bills ahead, so he has a lot of opportunities to get right with the nurses.
Now, it's not the only criticism that Newsom has faced this week. An executive order he issued late last month led some to think that money from the gas tax could be used for rail projects instead. On Wednesday, he refuted that. Carla, this was a rumor that was definitely making its way around Twitter. What sparked it?
That's right. I mean, well, let's remember SB1 is that law that boosted gas taxes and vehicle fees to raise money for transportation, maintenance, and highways, and to invest in mass transit. So it's been very controversial with Republicans, and the latest firestorm started when Newsom issued an executive order on September 20th. It basically directed more funds toward projects that would reduce the use of automobiles. I mean, he basically cited his whole climate change argument, and Caltrans responded to that executive order by proposing a delay in funding for three major highway improvements, in San Luis Obispo County in the Central Valley. The agency said it was reserving $61 million for priority rail projects and other priorities aligned with Newsom's executive order. And that is when Republicans cried foul. I mean, they essentially charged Newsom with a bait and switch, and they said that he was going to use the gas tax funds for his pet projects instead of what it was intended. So, you know, I asked Newsom about that this week in San Francisco. He was very adamant. He said, no, full stop, those gas tax funds are going to be used for transportation and that SB1 is locked in. And he said that he thought opponents might have been intentionally trying to stir up some trouble But he wanted to reassure voters out there that, and I'm quoting, transportation is a top priority. Maintenance is a top priority. And I think that message was greeted with applause by Assembly Speaker Anthony Rendon just minutes after it was published.
You know, Carla, Twitter can be a fun place for rumors when they're about fun stuff, like,
yes,
say, two rappers battling each other on social media. But this is serious stuff.
Absolutely.
And Jack, the gas tax is one of those lightning rod issues for Republicans in the state. Critics even got it on the ballot in 2018 for a repeal. Since this could be a cudgel for critics to use against him, should Newsom be making extra efforts to let people know, hey, this money is going toward the roads? I just want to stress.
On the one hand, Prop 6 lost by a margin of 57-43, which meant that people are okay with the gas tax increase, but the deal was the money was supposed to go to road repair. In fact, the title of the bill itself was the Road Repair and Accountability Act.
Yeah.
So he needs to make sure, he needs to really ride herd on this to make sure that the money actually goes and fixes the highways, even if he has to get a shovel and fill the potholes on the 110 himself.
That's when they'll have to roll up the sleeves. I love it when politicians roll up their sleeves and put, you know, a shovel in the dirt or something like that. I always think that's kind of a funny picture to see. We're talking State of Affairs with Jack Pitney, the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. Also, Carla Marinucci, Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Now, moving on, Senator and presidential hopeful Kamala Harris was flying high back in the polls back in July. Now she's down to mid-single digits. In a recent post, the statistical analysis website 538 explored a few reasons why. Carla, what might be going wrong for Kamala Harris right now?
Well, you know, it's too early to write her off, but let's remember that excitement when she first got in. This was an African-American woman who positioned herself as a progressive, you know, Kamala Harris for the people. That was the campaign slogan. But it's been a few months, and it's very clear she's got some big competition for some key votes that she's looking for, the African-American vote. That's Joe Biden and Cory Booker in that lane. And for the female vote, you know, Elizabeth Warren's been incredibly strong. Amy Klobuchar's coming on very strong this week. In the progressive lane, you know, you've got Beto, Julian Castro, even Andrew Yang, who is now incredibly ahead of Kamala Harris in Iowa.
Wow.
And he was basically unknown a year ago. You know, and then she's got the prosecutor label, which she may have probably mentioned a half a dozen times in last week's debate. And that is an issue with some progressives. So it's been this lingering question of who exactly does she appeal to? And, you know, the biggest problem may be her campaign itself. There's been talk of disconnect between that staff that she has here in San Francisco and her DC team. Her sister Maya has a big role in it. So, you know, there's some speculation. There's too many cooks in the kitchen here, maybe a candidate without a clear recipe for a win. But everybody's watching to see if she's going to be able to pull this one out.
Jack, what do you think of these theories? I just remember when she had that moment with Biden on stage, it televised nationally. It just seemed like, okay, that's what she needed to kind of go on and ride momentum. But it seems like it's fizzled a bit.
Yeah, and the article makes the point it's not just Kamala Harris's problems. It's the other candidate's strengths. Turns out Elizabeth Warren is a really, really good candidate. She had some problems this week explaining health care, but she's run a really, really strong campaign. Bernie Sanders, he had a heart attack, but he came back and he did really well in the debate and he put some of the concerns to rest. So it's not just that Kamala Harris is having problems, that the other candidates are doing a really good job.
Jack, is there a path for Senator Harris to come back right now?
Could be. She needs to find her unique selling proposition. One issue that she could emphasize that the other candidates haven't as much is the issue of disability rights. A poll this week showed that a majority of Americans, a majority, either have a disability or have a close relative or friend with a disability. And that's an issue that would resonate with a large number of Americans. It would be a natural issue for a Democratic constituency. But she's got to find some issue that separates her from the rest of the pack.
One more thing really quick for both of you. An opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal says California could actually work against Democrats running against President Trump, and it points to the power shutoffs last week, homelessness as signs of how liberal policies may have failed. What do you think? Jack, you first.
It would be a lot stronger if Eric Garcetti had run.
Carla, what about you?
Well, look, you know, this is the world's fifth largest economy. It's interesting that, you know, with the jobless numbers down to 4% here in California, Donald Trump today is taking credit for that. So there you go. Everybody wants a piece of California.
Jack Pitney is the Roy P. Crocker Professor of Politics at Claremont McKenna College. And Carla Marinucci is Senior Editor for Politico's California Playbook. Jack, Carla, have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Thanks.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Martinez. Cal State Fullerton is celebrating the one-year anniversary. A support service, it says, is unique in the nation. University housing for enrolled students who've served time in prison. It's part of a program called Project Rebound that exists at nine other Cal State campuses with others in the works. For more on the low-cost off-campus house, I'm joined by KPCC education correspondent Adolfo Guzman Lopez. Hey, Adolfo.
How's it going?
All right, so this house, where is it? What does it look like?
Well, it's in the Fullerton Hills, about 4 miles west of the campus. The first floor has some common areas, office for staff. The second floor is where the six residents live. It's run by a program called Project Rebound by university faculty and staff. There's some rules that you have to follow to live there. You have to keep your grades up. You pay 30% of your income as rent. You help do the chores. I was there yesterday. I spent some time there. They had an open house. I met Stephen Green. He's one of the residents. He moved in there 3 weeks ago. That's when he was released from prison. He told me that he took a lot of courses in college, I mean in prison, and he served 27 years for murder robbery. He said that living in the house is helping with this very difficult transition for him.
Like, I'm not outside trying to find, like, where would I get housing at? Where do I get a job at? Like, Project Rebound is helping me do everything. It's giving me a house. They're going to help me with get a job. Like, really, this is transition from the prison to the college.
Sounds like a second chance. Now, most college students have trouble finding an affordable place to live. What makes formerly incarcerated students different here?
Well, somebody else that I talked to yesterday, Daniel Bernal, he's a psychology major at Cal State Fullerton. I think he's a good example to illustrate this. He told me that he was released over 2 years ago. He spent 14 years in prison. He said he came from a broken home, had no immediate family when he was released to help him out, you know, find work and all that. There was a niece that he had never met. She agreed to let him stay at her apartment in Covina, but that didn't last too long.
My family told me that I had to leave the place where I was living with them at because the landlord found out, and me being a convicted felon and on parole, that they would get kicked out.
And it wasn't any easier for Daniel after that. He looked for apartments online, called landlords. He was really open about his conviction. He told landlords about it. And he said that as soon as he told them that, several landlords said, well, we're going to have some trouble with the police. The police are going to be coming here. And they didn't want any of the hassle, and they didn't want to rent to him.
Adolfo, how widespread is this program, and how many formerly incarcerated people does it wind up reaching?
Well, Project Rebound started at San Francisco State back in 1967, and up until about 3 or 4 years ago, it was the only Project Rebound in the 23-campus Cal State system. Then about 3 years ago, a little over half a dozen Project Rebounds started at several Cal State campuses, a couple here in Southern California. Each of the nine that exist right now serves fewer than 100 students. People are trying to reach out to the formerly incarcerated students on the campuses. Now, some students who've served time, they don't come forward. There's no box that you check when you apply for college,
right, yeah.
You know, to say, oh, I have a felony conviction, you know, as I'm applying to college. So organizers are constantly working to let the students know about the program.
Now, California, I know, has been grappling not only with its large prison population, but also millions of residents in the state who have criminal convictions. To what extent is Project Rebound a part of that particular discussion?
It is a part. Advocates say that a college education, be it community college, Cal State, UC, nearly guarantees that a convicted felon won't go back to prison. They say that supports like financial aid, housing aid, and here's one of the important ones. Talking to peers, talking to either students who are in college or formerly incarcerated students have gotten their degree, talking to them, hearing their experience, how they got through the transition makes a big difference. And not only for the individuals, but for the communities.
That's Adolfo Guzman Lopez, KPCC's education correspondent. Adolfo, thanks a lot.
You're welcome.
Moving on, California officials have invalidated over 1,000 scores on a state pharmacy exam after discovering some test takers had cheated. Pharmacists have responded with protests and petitions saying the decision has cost them job opportunities. LA Times reporter Selmaya Carlamunga has been covering this story. Welcome to Take Two.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Sure. Now, the test we're talking about is a qualifying exam to be a licensed pharmacist. How many people cheated and how do they do it?
So the pharmacy board knows that some people cheated, but they won't release how many. The only information they provided is that 100 test questions were leaked from the test bank and seemed to have been circulating online in some way, but they were pretty quiet on details.
So it could have been just a handful or a lot, and we don't know, and they won't say.
Yeah, it could have been definitely a handful. It might have just been 3 or 4. The problem is they're unable to figure out who looked at what was posted online.
So the option the California State Board of Pharmacy went with seems like the nuclear option. They invalidated all 1,400 tests taken in that time frame, including people who maybe didn't cheat. So why did the board make that decision?
So they said that they felt like the test had been compromised because of the cheating situation. And they felt like the only safe way to ensure that pharmacists in California are competent and that, you know, the pharmacy system is safe for consumers was to invalidate the test altogether. And they sort of acknowledged that it was a harsh decision, but they said that their obligation is as a consumer protection agency.
What kind of problems has this caused for people who did not cheat but had their scores canceled?
Oh, all sorts of problems. So a lot of these people graduated from pharmacy school, you know, after doing 4 years of a bachelor's, they did 4 years of pharmacy school, graduated in May, had their dream job lined up, whether that was at a hospital or at Walgreens or CVS, thinking that they would start in the fall once they got their exam scores and became licensed. But the fall rolled around, they never got their scores, so they couldn't get licensed. And so a lot of them lost their job opportunities and have had to take sort of lower level jobs that are, you know, pay less or just jobs in completely different fields. So I interviewed one woman who is a pharmacist. She actually had a job as a manager, like a pharmacy manager at CVS lined up. And now she works at H&M, the clothing store.
And I got to imagine this is tough for people who might be in a pinch having to pay student loans soon.
Yeah. So a lot of people's student loans kick in 6 months after graduation. So they have to start making payments in November, which, you know, is like 2 weeks away. And so one guy I talked to had, I think, $277,000 in student loans. And the loan agency is calling him and saying, like, are you ready to start making your payments? And he was trying to negotiate a later start date because he's working as a pharmacy intern because he's not licensed. So he's making about half of the money he thought he would be making at this point in his career.
Thousands of scores on a state pharmacy exam have been invalidated. We're talking about it with Los Angeles Times reporter Selmaya Carlamunga. Now, has the board reimbursed the people that have taken the test in any way on this?
So the board has set up 2 dates for people to retake the test at the end of November, and they're waiving the fee for if you take the test on those 2 days. But there are people who can't make those 2 days. And so if in that case, they will probably have to reapply to take the test, which means it'll be at an even later date, and it could cost $200.
What about any backlash from the pharmacist community? What do they want the state board to do?
So they're saying that the board should reverse the decision that it's made. They say that the obligation is on the board to figure out who cheated and to penalize those people, not to penalize everyone. So they say that the board should release the scores for all of the 1,400 people and then specifically invalidate the ones for the people they know definitely cheated. That way they won't have to retake the test. They can go on with their licensing. There's a change.org petition to try to make this happen. The California Pharmacists Association is trying to make that happen. There's some legislators who've gotten involved who think that the pharmacy board has sort of unnecessarily punished 1,400 people or whatever, 1,400 people minus the people who cheated, and that they need to do something about that.
So how do we know this won't happen again in the future?
I actually don't know what the pharmacy board has done to try to prevent this from happening in the future. It sounds a little bit like people, because the test is offered on a continuous basis, that people are remembering the test questions and then writing them down in some sort of document and sharing them. This is the first time it became this widespread, and I'd be surprised if the board didn't feel the need to take some serious action to prevent this from happening again.
That's LA Times reporter Soumya Karlamangla. Thank you very much for taking the time.
Of course. Thank you.
Back now with more Take 2 on 89.3 KPCC. I'm Amy Martinez. Here we are for another edition of Food Fridays. That's when we chat with colleagues and contributors from our sister site, LAist.com, about one of our favorite subjects, and that's food. This week, we have Quincy Surasmith here to teach us how to shop like a pro in Thai markets. Quincy, thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me.
All right, so first off, I want to touch on the importance of these markets to the customers they serve. So tell us about some of the families that own these markets and what they mean to Thai communities in LA.
You know, these Thai markets were kind of the foundation of what we consider now Thai Town, right? Back in the 70s, early 70s, you know, there was a small Thai American community here, but a lot of them didn't have access to the produce and groceries, the fresh ingredients that they would have needed to cook kind of Thai food at home. But then Bangkok Market opened up in 1971 over on Melrose and Normandy by the Tilaka Mongkol family. And not only did they open that market up to make that produce available, but they had to navigate all the imports and produce supply chains and warehouses and stuff. So they kind of built not just that market, but the infrastructure for the other markets to come and all the grocery stores and communities later to bring all these ingredients and produce into the community.
All right. So let's start off with herbs and spices, fresh ones. They're the major flavor boosters for Thai cuisine. Which are your standbys, Quincy?
A lot of people think of Thai basil, but there's actually two kinds of Thai basil, right? There's kapau and there's horapa, right? They're both in the basil family, but they have a little bit of different herbiness to it. Mm. One's a little bit more kind of a aniseed or licorice-y kind of back flavor to it. Kapau, for example, which is holy basil, is going to have a lot more punch and be able to stand up to the chilies and stuff if you're stir frying it with like meat and vegetables. The other one I think is going to be used more as like a closing garnish. You might see it more often in Vietnamese Americans share the same herb, right? So you'll see that in like pho soups.
All right. Now, so staying with the flavor all-stars, this one might not be as well known, but it's the secret weapon in most Thai dishes. I'll let you say it, Quincy. Tell us about it.
So it's called nam pik pao, right? And that basically just translates to roast chili paste or toasted chili paste.
Okay.
It's not just chilies, though. It's got palm sugar in there, kind of a shrimp paste, so it's a little bit briny, and it's also not vegetarian safe, in case anyone's concerned about
that. That's important to know, though, right?
Yeah. I make a mac and cheese with it, actually. Not a traditional dish.
Really?
Yeah. So it's not just the heat. It's like a savoriness, and in a lot of tom yum soups, right? A lot of people love Thai tom yum or tom yum, if you're not going to pronounce it the traditional way. Whenever you see kind of a floating, like, red particulates in a soup, that might be from nam pik pao.
So you make a mac and cheese with it, though, right?
Yeah, I think it works really well with dairy and stuff because that briny spiciness can stand up to that like heavy, rich cream flavors of my mac and cheese or a grilled cheese or anything like that as well.
We've worked together here for quite some time, and Quincy, you have never shared this dish with me. What gives?
Or have you had it? Because I've brought it to the Thanksgiving potluck at least 2 years now.
That's my problem.
You got to join the lunch club.
I'm so busy putting together Take Two every day that I don't take part of the potluck. But I will now. If you're going to bring that thing, I promise I will. We're talking to Quincy Surasmith, teaching us how to shop like a pro in Thai markets. Now, what are other musts that should be on people's Thai market shopping lists? Name a few more gotta-haves for the listeners.
For me, a few key things are Thai-style sriracha. Now, a lot of people know about famous Vietnamese-American sriracha, right? And I respect that so much, right?
Oh, here it comes.
It's not that it's better or worse. The kind I grew up with is just different. They come in glass bottles. They're smoother. You can pour them out. They're for dipping meats and seafoods. There's these kind of bananas that I also love, Nam Hoa bananas. The Nam Hoa bananas are smaller. They're a little stouter. They're like half the length of a Cavendish banana. And to me, they taste sweeter, a little bit tartar. They have more of that fruit flavor. I think an American banana tastes a little bit starchier.
Yeah.
And these are great fresh, but they also make great banana fritters. It's one of my favorite Thai kind of snack foods.
Now, Thai food, pretty popular here in LA. Cooking, though, is another story. Intimidating for some people. For those who might be afraid, Quincy, to recreate these dishes at home, what are some key ingredients they should have? Stuff they have to have all the time if they want to try Thai cuisine at home.
Oh man, number one is going to be fish sauce, right? Yeah. Like fish sauce is just
even
so
I know
key.
That
because that's what adds that salt seasoning flavor, right? But it's also that like briny fish flavor. It's in your pad thai. It's in a lot of our soups. It's in a lot of our stir fries. Now, a lot of folks who can't have fish products, Thai folks also have various kinds of soy sauces. We call them siu, and there's what we call siu khao, which is white soy sauce, which is like a light salty soy sauce. Siu dam or black soy sauce, which is a little bit thicker, a little bit sweeter, and then we have siu wan, which is a sweet soy sauce, and that's even thicker. It's really similar to Indonesian ketsup manis. Now, these are not fully interchangeable with fish sauce, but they can still add a lot of like savory, salty, and sometimes sweet punch to your dishes as well. The rest of the stuff are things like shallots, Thai chilies, garlic, lemongrass, mint. These herbs and these sauces are going to be really what makes it kind of a little bit more Thai.
All right, so say I have all those ingredients on my counter, and I'm staring at them, and I'm still worried, and I need one more thing. Words of wisdom or words of advice, encouragement, whatever, Quincy, from you.
If you're not selling it, if you're not trying to win awards or be out there, just make what tastes good to you, right? Don't be afraid to play around and experiment. A lot of Thai cuisine is made by taste from experience, partially because different soy sauce brands, different fish sauces, different chilies and vegetables and herbs aren't going to taste the same piece by piece. They're not industrialized ingredients. So the way Thai folks would have learned it is also by taste, right? In a perfect world, you go to a great Thai restaurant, see how it tastes there, and then when you go home, you have a reference point. You have a guiding star.
That's LAS contributor Quincy Surasmith, also assistant producer with KPCC's in-person team. He's been our guiding star on shopping LA's Thai markets. And for a more detailed grocery list and tons of picks to go along with it, visit our partner site, LAIST.com. That's LAIST.com. Quincy, thanks a lot.
Thanks so much for having me.
Finally, before we get back to Pledge, we pledge to help you have a great weekend.
I'm KPCC's Leo Duran, and A. Martinez, I'm all out of tricks because this October weekend, there are almost too many treats to hit up. So many cool events.
All right, so what's up first?
Okay, so there are a few Dia de los Muertos fests happening. One starts today in downtown and runs through the end of the month. It's more of an art installation, Instagrammable place at the gallery Wisdome, LA, in downtown. Think of this as a sensory journey where you can selfie yourself to death. This one costs $29 for entry, but if your bank account is as bare as a skeleton, then head over to El Sereno tomorrow for this free event. It's the 10th annual Dia de los Muertos Festival featuring art, dancing, and music. Musicians like Luis Cruz Beltran and Mariachi Divas will be there. Then there will be a procession to wrap up the night.
All right, also this weekend is to celebrate the life of a furry creature.
That's right, P22.
Ooh.
That's the name of the only mountain lion that lives in Griffith Park. This dude has a day all to himself tomorrow in celebration as part of Urban Wildlife Week. So actually, on the event's website, it has a quote from P22 himself. Didn't know he spoke English.
Oh, no.
It's, quote, "Ain't no party like a mountain lion party, because a mountain lion party don't stop." And if the lion is saying that, you know it's got to be good. So when you go, you can get a VR experience of wildlife crossings, hear from experts all about the other creatures in the park, plus food, music, and family-friendly stuff all around. And this one's free, too.
P22, one cool cat. All right, now, finally, what about for people who want to party?
Well, maybe you might see me tonight at this. I do my hair. That, of course, is Lizzo. And starting tonight, she performs 4 nights in a row in LA. It's a marathon for her. And this is one of the hottest tickets in town. So tickets might be sold out, but you know how there are always resellers who can't go for one reason or another. Yeah. And they originally retailed for around $90. Plus, I just kind of wanted to mention her to get amped up myself because I'm going with...
you are?
Yeah, I'm going with reporter Alyssa Jung Perry. So if you spot us tonight, say hi. Now, that is not all. The KPCC LAist gang have a lot more to share of what to do this weekend. You can check it out on LAist.com. That is LAIST.com. And you can find me on Twitter at Leo Has a Cat.
And that's our own Leo Duran. Leo, thanks a lot.
See you later, A.